From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're ending the year with our series Last Laughs, featuring some of our more entertaining interviews from 2004. On today's Fresh Air, David Sedaris talks about his latest bestseller, Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim, and he reads a story from it. And Cheryl Hines talks about starring in the HBO comedy series Curb Your Enthusiasm. She plays Larry David's wife. We'll also hear jazz critic Kevin Whitehead's review of Careless Love, the new CD from singer Madeline Peru. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Sunday's earthquake and tsunami in South Asia is now blamed for at least 52,000 deaths. Indonesia and Sri Lanka were hardest hit, but 12 countries have reported deaths. U.S. relief organizations are rushing medical supplies and other aid to the affected areas, but the logistics are daunting. NPR's Margo Adler reports.
At AmeriCares, the disaster relief organization that works to aid healthcare around the world, a team is set to land shortly in Sri Lanka with medicines and water purification equipment. At Catholic Relief Services, workers are on the ground in India and Thailand. Mary E. McClymont is the CEO of Interaction, an alliance of American humanitarian non-governmental organizations. She says donations are welcome, but she adds,
"The best thing they can do is give cash, because that is the most reliable way of making sure that the relief supplies get into the hands of the people who need it."
Some relief organizations are just beginning to assess the situation. The director of AmeriCares International Program said, "We still don't know how huge this is." Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
Iraqi rebels killed at least 25 people today, most of them members of the police and security forces. The rebels attacked a police post near Tikrit, dragging out and killing a dozen men. Other attacks in the Sunni Muslim region north of Baghdad left at least 5 policemen and several National Guardsmen dead. A group led by Jordanian terrorist Abu Musab al-Zarqawi has claimed responsibility for yesterday's attempt to assassinate a prominent Shiite political leader. That attack left 13 people dead and more than 50 wounded. The winner of Ukraine's repeat presidential election, Viktor Yushchenko, is calling for his supporters to blockade the country's main government building. Yushchenko wants to prevent Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych, who he defeated in Sunday's election, from holding a cabinet meeting. NPR's Lauren Sheets reports from Kiev.
Yushchenko! Yushchenko!
Tens of thousands of opposition supporters gathered under fireworks in Independence Square to celebrate Viktor Yushchenko's victory. But Prime Minister Yanukovych is still refusing to concede. He says fraud and voter disenfranchisement caused his 8-point loss to Yushchenko, despite international observers who said the election was generally fair. Yanukovych said he would return from campaign leave to chair a government meeting Wednesday. Opposition supporters called that a provocation. Yushchenko told his supporters on the square to blockade the building so that Yanukovych can't enter. Yanukovych had vowed to bring his own backers onto the streets after the election, but the planned protests have not materialized. Lawrence Sheets, NPR News, Kiev.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 78 points to close at 10,854 in light trading. The Nasdaq was up 23 to 2177. This is NPR News. A winter storm from the Pacific is pounding California for a second day, flooding freeways and causing hundreds of traffic accidents. Forecasters say some mountain areas could receive up to a foot of rain before the day is over, raising fears of mudslides in some areas that were burned by last year's wildfires. The storm also brought winds gusting to 60 miles an hour. Southern California Edison reported that about 10,000 customers lost electric power. Thousands of Ohioans are now enduring their sixth day without electricity, and a major utility company says some of them may have to wait several more days for power to be restored. Bill Cohen reports from Ohio Public Radio.
Last Thursday, more than 300,000 Ohio homes had their power cut off by an ice storm. Now, about 50,000 homes remain without electricity. American Electric Power says it has repair crews from a dozen states working to restore power here. But the last homes are the hardest because many of them are unique cases. AEP spokeswoman Vicki Milholsky says they're not like the earlier cases where one repair job restores power to dozens or hundreds of houses at a time.
Instead of going out where you have 200 customers affected by an outage, you have to go from location to location to restore those individual customers.
AEP now says some homes may have to wait until early next week for power. That would mean they'd be without electricity for a week and a half. For NPR News, I'm Bill Cohen in Columbus.
Consumers were more optimistic about the economy this month, in part because of an improving job market and cheaper energy prices. The conference board said today that its index of consumer confidence rose nearly 10 points in December after declining for 4 months in a row. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending the year with a series called Last Laughs, featuring some of our more entertaining interviews of 2004. We continue the series with David Sedaris. Like many of his fans, I first fell in love with his writing when he read his story, Santaland Diaries, on NPR's Morning Edition. That now-famous piece told about his experiences working as an elf in Macy's Santaland. Ira Glass had produced Sedaris for Morning Edition, and when Glass started his own show, This American Life, David became a regular. Now David Sedaris is a literary phenomenon. He's written several bestsellers collecting his humorous personal essays and stories. He reads to sold-out theaters around the country. His bookstore appearances often have lines around the block. When he got famous in America, he moved to Paris, where he could barely speak the language. Now he also has a place in London where it's a lot easier to understand what people are saying to him. David Sedaris' latest bestseller is a book of stories called Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim. When I spoke with him in June, I asked him first to read a story from the book called Hejira. The title comes from a Joni Mitchell song.
It wasn't anything I had planned on, but at the age of 22, after dropping out of my second college and traveling across the country a few times, I found myself back in Raleigh, living in my parents' basement. After 6 months spent waking at noon, getting high, and listening to the same Joni Mitchell record over and over again, I was called by my father into his den and told to get out. He was sitting very formally in a big, comfortable chair behind his desk, and I felt as though he was firing me from the job of being his son. I'd been expecting this to happen, and it honestly didn't bother me all that much. The way I saw it, being kicked out of the house was just what I needed if I was ever going to get back on my feet. "Fine," I said. "I'll go. But one day you'll be sorry." I had no idea what I meant by this. It just seemed like the sort of thing a person should say when he was being told to leave. My sister Lisa had an apartment over by the university and said I could come stay with her as long as I didn't bring my Joni Mitchell record. My mother offered to drive me over, and after a few bong hits, I took her up on it. It was a 15-minute trip across town, and on the way we listened to the rebroadcast of a radio call-in show in which people phoned the host to describe the various birds gathered around their backyard feeders. Normally the show came on in the morning, and it seemed strange to listen to it at night. The birds in question had gone to bed hours ago, and probably had no idea they were still being talked about. I chewed this over, and wondered if anyone back at the house was talking about me. To the best of my knowledge, no one had ever tried to imitate my voice or describe the shape of my head, and it was depressing that I went unnoticed while a great many people seemed willing to drop everything for a cardinal. My mother pulled up in front of my sister's apartment building, and when I opened the car door, she started to cry, which worried me, as she normally didn't do things like that. It wasn't one of those I'm going to miss you things, but something sadder and more desperate than that. I wouldn't know it until months later, but my father had kicked me out of the house not because I was a bum, but because I was gay. Our little talk was supposed to be one of those defining moments that shape a person's adult life, but he'd been so uncomfortable with the most important word that he'd left it out completely, saying only, "I think we both know why I'm doing this." I guess I could have pinned him down. I just hadn't seen the point. Is it because I'm a failure? A drug addict? A sponge? Come on, Dad, just give me one good reason. Who wants to say that? My mother assumed that I knew the truth and it tore her apart. Here was yet another defining moment, and again I missed it entirely. She cried until it sounded as if she were choking. "I'm sorry," she said. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry." I figured that within a few weeks I'd have a job in some crummy little apartment. It didn't seem insurmountable, but my mother's tears made me worry that finding these things might be a little harder than I thought. Did she honestly think I was that much of a loser? "Really," I said, "I'll be fine." The car light was on, and I wondered what the passing drivers thought as they watched my mother sob. What kind of people did they think we were? Did they think she was one of those crybaby moms who fell apart every time someone chipped a coffee cup? Did they assume I'd said something to hurt her? Did they see us as just another crying mother and her stoned gay son, sitting in a station wagon and listening to a call-in show about birds? Or do they imagine, for just one moment, that we might be special?
Gee, David, thanks for reading that. That's a great, great story. My guest is David Sedaris, and he just read the story Hejira from his new collection, Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim. When this actually happened to you, and your mother explained to you why you were really thrown out of the house, did you think about the possibility that your parents had just had this big fight about you and about how to handle you?
And I did, and I suppose I was surprised that I was so unaware of it happening. But I was just in front in the rocking chair in the basement listening to that Joni Mitchell album, so all kinds of things could have been going on, and I wouldn't have been aware of them. But I never felt that panic that, oh my God, they're throwing a man out of the house and they're never going to talk to me again. Because my father's the kind of guy who, you can have an argument with him and he can even throw you out of the house, but a couple hours later he's forgotten about it. I mean, he doesn't have Alzheimer's or anything, but he has a really, just this wonderful ability to put things behind him. And I've always been very impressed by that. So my dad got upset that I was gay and he threw me out of the house, but I was back a few days later.
So how did he react to you being gay after that first reaction of throwing you out?
Well, I was never like a slut. You know, I mean, I was never like the kind of guy who dragged people home or wore T-shirts. I was never that kind of a homosexual. And my dad, I thought that he was used to the idea, but I have a dear friend named Evelyn who lives in Chicago, and gee, I've known her for 20 years. She's 10 years older than me, and when I got out of college, I lived in her house for a while. And 5 years ago, I was talking about Evelyn. My dad said, "She's a great gal. Why don't you marry her?" And, well, A, I'm gay, and B, she lives in Chicago. I mean, there are like 18 reasons why I wouldn't marry her, one of which is I've been with Hugh for 13 years. But he's making an effort. When my dad calls, he'll say, "Put Hugh on the phone." And then Dad doesn't quite know what to say to Hugh, but, you know, it's a nice gesture. He won't be one of those people that wears a T-shirt that says, "I'm so happy that my son likes other guys." He won't go that far, but he comes to accept it.
You know who in the story you just read, when, you know, after your father tells you you have to leave the house and you don't know why he's telling you that, you don't realize it's because you're gay, you're thinking someday you're going to be sorry. Did you ever have the desire of throwing that back in his face, of saying, "Well, Dad, this is how unenlightened you are, or this is how mean you can be," you know, at an opportune time when you needed to get even with him about something?
I did, but I always felt it was third rate. Like, I always felt when I yelled at my father, or if I said, I remember once I said, "You're going to die alone." And I felt like I was being
nice.
So prophetic at the time. Uh-huh. And now I think back on it and I think, God, parents just must, it must be so heartbreaking to be a parent and hear your kid say something like that, mm-hmm. Something so unoriginal. I mean, if they said something original or something thought-provoking or funny, it might be okay. But you would just want to say, "Oh, God, I said that same thing to my parents, you know, and, you know, surprise, you're going to die alone too."
David, a lot of the stories in this book are set in your childhood or in your teen years. And I'm wondering if it was like a conscious choice to spend some time writing about that part of your life, or whether this this is more coincidental?
I think it's more coincidental. I'd been writing a lot for Ira's show, This American Life, and he throws out a theme for every show. And so sometimes the themes just happen to work best. If I looked over the scope of my life, they happen to work best in childhood. But I didn't consciously. I think if I was conscious about it, I would try to get away from that. I think there are so many traps to fall into when you write about childhood.
What are the traps?
Well, I think you can. There's a tendency to make yourself seem more clever than you were. And I was not a clever child at all. I was not a well-read child. I think I was just a kind of a child that I think you'd think, damn it, that's my son? That has to be my son? You know, like sometimes you see someone with an ugly baby and you think, they must look at that baby sometimes and think, damn it, I wish I'd slept with somebody else. And I always felt like that, you know, like an ugly boy who's not necessarily clever and not athletic in any way, and just a general all around. You just think, oh, maybe he'll grow up and move away from home. That would be the most that you could hope for.
You've said that when you were young, you didn't read a lot. Did you write?
No, I wrote in high school. I had to write papers, and it was just, like, horrible for me. And I was like most people. I put it off until the night before the paper was due, and there was no sense of style to it whatsoever. And I wanted to be a visual artist, but I don't have any talent for that. But I was still giving it a try. And then I was 20 years old one day, and I just started writing. Like, I didn't know the day before that I would do it. I just started writing one day. And at around that same time, I started reading everything that I could get my hands on. So I wasn't one of those people that... I wasn't a child who thought, I'm going to grow up and I'm going to be a writer. It came as a complete surprise to me. And I think that's sort of heartening, that can happen to anybody. You know, anybody can, maybe tomorrow. Like a couple of years ago, Hugh and I spent the summer in Normandy. And I discovered, I say discovered, but they already existed, spiders. And I am so incredibly interested in spiders now. And at this moment at our house in Normandy, there's probably 800 spiders in the house. And there's one huge, it's a kind of a spider that's a shape, the size of an unshelled peanut with legs on it, the Tegenaria gigantea. And feeding these spiders and recording their habits and studying them under a microphone, under a microscope, it's changed my life. But I didn't know the day before, the day before I saw a fly into a web and be eaten by a spider, I didn't know that this would be a huge passion in my life. And I just think that's so exciting that we have that ability to embrace things that we don't even see coming. I mean, it really is. It sounds kind of corny, but it's a reason to live. And who knows what it might be next? I mean, I'd be surprised if all of a sudden I got into that foot boxing. You know, like that would be a real surprise to me. But who knows? There could be something tomorrow or... Well, actually, I have my hands full with the spiders right now. So, but something could happen 10, 15 years from now that might cause me to look at the world in a completely different way.
Oh, I know what you mean. That's wonderful to see it that way. What is it about spiders?
I think that we have these webs hanging, like almost like a campaign bunting throughout the throughout the house, and it's a three-story house. And I never was really, you never really saw the spiders because they're back in their little, they live in a little cavity at the end of at the back of the web. But then I saw a fly, and then I saw the spider come out and grab it. And it was fascinating. And then I just started catching flies to feed to the spiders. And at first I caught them with my fingers. The best place to get a fly is against a window pane. They get confused there, and so you can grab them. So for a while I was catching them with my fingers, but it was more practical. I started catching them in a jar, and then I shake the jar up like it's a cocktail, and I pour the fly into the web. And The fly lands and he's sort of punch drunk for a moment. He's like, what happened? Where am I? And then the second he starts to move, the spider comes out. And I just, you know, it's like rooting for the Nazi in a Holocaust movie. It really is. It makes me feel bad sometimes. But, you know, these are flies. So I'm not going to, you know, they go out in the yard and they walk through feces and they come in and dance on the furniture. I mean, if anyone has it coming, it's flies. And I think more than the spiders, it was catching the flies. It just fit into this obsessive, it was like an obsession that has been waiting for me all my life. I mean, it fulfills me completely. I will spend 6 hours at a stretch catching flies. When we run out of flies in our own house, I go to the neighbors and ask if I can borrow some of theirs. So even more than the spiders, it's catching the flies. And the spiders in our house are full, you know? they're like, oh, not again. There's only so much that they can eat. But I love catching flies. Love it.
My guest is David Sedaris. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Sedaris. His latest collection of stories is called Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim. When we left off, he was talking about his recent obsession with watching spiders and collecting flies. Well, I know you see this new interest in spiders and flies as being an obsession, and you have described yourself in your writing as being obsessive compulsive. And you say something in one of the stories in your new book, you say something really funny about that. You say, the good part about being an obsessive compulsive is that you're always on time for work. The bad part is that you're on time for everything. Rinsing your cup of coffee, taking a bath, walking your clothes to the laundromat. There's no mystery to your comings and goings. No room for spontaneity. Now, here's something that amazes me. If you are so involved with routine and the kind of predictability of routine or the reliability of routine, how have you managed to move to foreign countries? You know, you moved to Paris, now you also have a place in London, and in addition to that, you tour a lot. You go on book tours and you do maybe a city a day for a month or two. How do you deal with that?
Well, if let's say if my plane leaves at 7, right, then they're going to come and take me to the airport at 5:30. Then I just get up at 4. And I write. And as long as I can write every day, then that's something I can do every day. I can take the other bits of it, right? So if I don't get to take a bath tomorrow, or if my suitcase is lost and I don't get to iron a shirt, I can deal with it because there's one thing that I can still do every day. I sort of like those tours. I mean, people always say, you get off the plane and then someone says, oh, you must be exhausted. And you think, oh, I am. Then you think, wait a minute, I haven't done anything. You know, I just took a half-hour plane ride. How exhausting is that in the scheme of things? So I like those tours because it feels like they feel like a business trip to me. They make me feel I never had a real job, so it never occurred to me that I would get to do that. And I just put it in my head that I'm a businessman. And I'm a businessman, and I'm on a trip for a month. And that helps me get through a lot.
I don't know if I ever shared this theory with you, but I've often wondered if your move to Paris... let me put it this way. I know when you were young, you always wanted... I think I knew this anyways, that when you were young, you wanted to be well-known, you know, as a writer. The idea of being, you know, celebrated was something that you wanted. But as soon as you kind of got it, you left town. You left the country and went to a place where people didn't know who you were and you didn't even speak the language. And it always seemed to me almost as a way of intentionally or unintentionally protecting yourself from being too well-known, protecting yourself against celebrity?
Well, I think, but that's something you can't really write about. You know, like if you write about somebody giving you, you know, recognizing your name on your credit card and so giving you a free meal in a restaurant, you can't write about that because other people can't really relate. It didn't happen to them. And you can't complain about it because people think, what the hell is he complaining about? You know, I had to pay and leave a tip. So, and I think I tend to write better from the viewpoint of somebody who's having to struggle for something. And so therefore moving to France, it was just sort of starting over and having to, you know, asking for even the smallest thing. And now, having been there for 6 years, it's so hard for me to open my mouth. So I feel very foreign there. And part of it, too, is I think, you know, you grow up and you think, God, I would give anything if someone came up to me and said that they'd read something that I had written and that they liked it. And then when they do, you just want it to be over with. You know they mean well, but, you know, I just sort of dig the nails of my hand into my palm to make anything hurt more.
Why?
Than this. It's just, I mean, you want people to read what you've written, and you want them to enjoy it, and you want them to tell you about it. Actually, you want them to tell you about it. I think what you want them to tell your younger self, how much they liked it. Like the 20-year-old me would really appreciate it. And the 47-year-old me is just sort of embarrassed by it. There's a writer named Akhil Sharma who wrote a book called An Obedient Father, and it was the best novel that I'd read that year. Boy, it was just a magnificent book. And he came to my reading. And I know that I embarrassed him because I should have just gotten down and knelt on the ground before him. That's basically what I did, except with words. And I think that I embarrassed him. But at the same time, I needed to say that. I needed to say that I think that that he is probably the most inventive writer that lives in America right now. And that one of the reasons that I do not kill myself is the possibility that he'll write another book. And so maybe when people say nice things to me, I understand that they need to say it. And then you need to be gracious, and you need to, I guess it's just being embarrassed, I suppose.
David Sedaris, recorded in June. His latest book is Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, our series Last Laughs continues with Cheryl Hines. She plays Larry David's wife on the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a CD from singer Madeline Peru. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending the year with our series Last Laughs, featuring some of our more entertaining interviews from 2004. In November, I spoke with Cheryl Hines. She plays Larry David's wife, Cheryl David, on the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. She started her career performing with the comedy improv group The Groundlings, which celebrated its 30th anniversary this year. Some of the other Groundling alumni include Phil Hartman, John Lovitz, Will Ferrell, Paul Rubens, Lisa Kudrow, Julia Sweeney, and Lorraine Newman. Cheryl Hines gets to use a lot of her improv skills on Curb. The series centers around Larry David, the co-creator of the series Seinfeld. In each edition of Curb, he manages to insult and alienate friends, family, and strangers. Here's a scene from last season. Larry and Cheryl David are having a ceremony to renew their wedding vows. Cheryl wants Larry to work on his vows. She's already started working on hers.
So this is what I have so far. May I always have the wisdom to look past your shortcomings and appreciate all of the goodness you possess. We promise to continue loving each other unconditionally, not only throughout this lifetime, but after death through all eternity. We stand before you.
What is it?
What?
Was that about eternity?
We will love each other throughout this lifetime, but after death through all eternity.
You mean this is continuing into the afterlife?
Yeah, that's the idea. Do you have a problem with that?
Well, I thought this was over at death. I didn't know we went into eternity together. Isn't that what it said in Till Death Do Us Part? I thought it was...
Do you have a problem with eternity?
Well...
We finally found each other, Larry, and we're celebrating this for all eternity.
I guess I had a different plan for eternity. I thought I'd be single, I guess.
I'm sorry. I'm interrupting your single life in eternity?
No, I just didn't realize that this relationship carried over after death.
Well, it does. It carries over.
So I guess I just took that for granted.
Okay. Do you not want to renew our vows because...
No, I want to renew our vows until, you know, I didn't... Can we take out the eternity part?
No.
Okay.
Cheryl Hines, how did you end up joining the Groundlings?
Well, I had moved out here from Florida, and I was bartending at a hotel downtown, and I met one of Phil Hartman's sisters at the bar. She was staying in the hotel, and she started saying that she wanted to go to this theater called The Groundlings on Melrose, because that's where her brother got his start. And when I found out it was Phil Hartman, and at that time he was on SNL, something clicked over, like, oh, that's how you go from Tallahassee, Florida to SNL. You just go to the Groundlings. No, I didn't figure it was that easy, but I thought there must be something great about that theater if that's where Phil Hartman got a start. So I immediately went to a show as soon as I had a night off, and I was blown away. And at that time, I didn't even have a refrigerator because it was so broke. And I so wanted to take classes at the Groundlings, and I couldn't afford it. And every day I would come into work, and I would talk about the Groundlings, and that's all I talked about. And for my birthday, all of the people I worked with and the regulars that came in all chipped in to buy my first class at the Groundlings.
Oh, that's so nice. Were you a waitress?
I was a bartender, yeah.
Bartender, yeah. Oh, that's that's really, really nice. So
it was great.
How'd you pay for your second class?
I cried a lot. Well, I continued to talk to the regulars and tell them how I was growing as an actress and how it was important for them to tip me well. And what's really interesting is I ended up meeting Phil backstage at the Groundlings a few years later. And it was, you know, a magical moment. He just walked by and said a few funny words, and I was certain that that's where I was supposed to be at that moment.
What was your audition like for Curb Your Enthusiasm?
Well, I had an audition that was scheduled. They called me about an hour before my audition and said, you know what, we're really running behind we're going to have to postpone your audition. And that, you know, is kind of Hollywood speak for you're not coming in. Which at the time was okay with me because, you know, I didn't really know who Larry David was. I knew he created Seinfeld, and that's exciting. But I didn't, none of it really registered like this was going to be a huge, big thing. It was an hour special on HBO. From the description of the wife, you know, the part that I went in for, I didn't think I was right for it. So when they told me that I wasn't going in, I was okay. And that night, I was doing sketch comedy. It wasn't at the Groundlings, but it was material that I created at the Groundlings. And the director and the producer of the Curb Your Enthusiasm special was at, they were both at the show that night. And they saw one of the sketches that I had written and I performed it. And they thought that my sense of humor kind of matched up with Larry's. And they called me in the next morning.
What did they tell you about your character and about his character?
They told me, you know, with the part of Larry's wife doesn't put up with a lot of bull, that she's heard it all from him before, and she stands up to him, basically. So that's all they told me. And I went in, and at that point, they were thinking that we were going to have kids on the show, which in the special, we did. I thought you never saw them, but we talked about them. But anyway, so my first scene that I did with them, we were just sitting next to each other, and he said, I don't think you put enough milk in the kid's cereal bowl. He said, I don't understand why you can't just fill it all the way up to the top. And I said, well, there's no reason to. You know, if you cover the flakes, they're fine. And then you give them a glass of milk if they want to drink the milk. He's like, yeah, but we can afford it. Why don't we just go ahead and fill it up all the way? I said, because there's no point in it. There's just milk that sits left over and it goes to waste. And he's like, well, why don't you just try it? So it was really one of those. And then we did another scene where he told me that he wasn't going to eat chicken. That's all he told me. And then he goes, okay, so let's, you know, we'll improvise a scene. And he asked me what we were having for dinner. You know, and I said that we were having potatoes and green beans and chicken. And he said, I just told you I'm not eating chicken. And I said, well, so the rest of your family doesn't get to eat chicken? I said, you don't have to eat the chicken. Every time you say you're not going to do something, we don't do it. It'll be, you know, we can't live like that. Because you're neurotic, we're not going to have to live our lives like that. So don't eat the chicken. But he was like, he couldn't believe that I said that we were going to have chicken after he just told me that he wasn't eating chicken anymore. So we laughed a lot, actually, in that audition.
So I guess you had the personality they were looking for.
Well, they said that they were kind of running into people that were either too pushy and too confrontational, or as soon as he got confrontational, they would back off and their feelings would get hurt. So I guess I was a happy medium. I don't know.
So how does improvisation and how does all the work that you did with the Groundlings figure in now to your work on Curb Your Enthusiasm with Larry David?
Well, I'm sure that I would not have this job if I didn't have my training at the Groundlings. Because, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm is all improvised. We get a story outline that's about 8 or 9 pages long, and then all the dialogue is improvised. So before I came to the Groundlings, I had not had any improv training, only in acting classes for, an exercise, maybe. They would say, do something improvised. But it was never meant to be funny. So the Groundlings really helped me to understand what improv is all about. Now, while I'm saying this, I can imagine Larry David listening to this interview going, it's not so hard. But that's what he thinks about acting. He always thinks that people that have had training act like it's all so hard, and it's not so hard. He always says, you know, if you're supposed to have a stomach ache, you act like you have a stomach ache. It's not so hard. You grab your stomach and moan.
Of course, he's playing himself, more or less.
Yeah, of course. Exactly. So I'm sure if he heard me talking about improv and how, you know, it's good to be trained, he would be making fun of me. But
That's what you want in a co-star, isn't it? Someone who can make fun of you.
Yes. But listen, I get mocked at every turn, I have to tell you. But I would not have felt comfortable going into that audition, I think, if I hadn't had training at the Groundlings, because it seems it can be intimidating, improvising, especially coming from a theater background where they tell you that it's all about the what's on the page and what other characters say about you in the script and what your character says in the script, and you analyze every word and every motivation. So in theater, for me anyway, that's where you start. You start with the script. So to all of a sudden be in a theater and you don't have a script, it's a strange place.
What's it like to work with him?
It's like going to summer camp when you're 13. Or it's like, you know, when you're in high school and you go into chemistry class and everybody gets paired up for lab partners. It's like I got paired up with the smartest, dorkiest guy in class. And then you realize quickly into it that you're having the best time. And that he knows all the answers. And I spend most of my drive home just laughing to myself. What a crazy job I have.
Have you ever been absolutely speechless by something that he said?
Well, I have been. And if you watch the show, you'll see several times where I don't even know what to say to him. I usually... It takes me a while to process what he just told me. So sometimes I'll just be like, you know, why would you tell someone that, why would you congratulate them on his son having a big penis? You know what I mean? It's like, that. Why would that come out of your mouth? So there are moments like that where I just have to process it before I can respond to him. So I'm mostly just asking why.
My guest is Cheryl Hines. She plays Larry David's wife, Cheryl David, on HBO's Curb Your Enthusiasm. Here's a scene from the first season.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
I'm just curious, okay? Why am I the one that always has to initiate sex? You ever thought about that?
Okay, I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
I gotta cramp my foot. I'm available for sex all the time.
Is that right?
Basically. So anytime you want to have it, you can have it.
Wow.
But anytime I want to have it, I can't. So just assume that I want it all the time. So whenever you want it, just tap me on the shoulder.
Oh, Jesus.
Okay.
That's so not how it should go.
Well, otherwise I'll be making moves all the time. Do you want that? Do you want somebody just mauling you all the time? That's what I will do. I will treat your breasts as if they're mine. Do you want that?
Once in a while. I mean, I don't want you walking around.
Would you
like
that if I walked around like that?
No, huh? I'm just saying.
That's how I walk around. I need borders. I need boundaries.
Okay. Once in a while, give it a try. That's all I'm saying. Okay?
All right, well, okay.
All right. Fine. Oh, not now.
Cheryl Hines will be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with actress Cheryl Hines. She plays Larry David's wife, Cheryl, on the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. I'm sure you've had to ask yourself, why does your character stay married to him on the show when he's so inconsiderate and so tone deaf to the needs of other people, including his wife?
Well, well, first of all, she really does love him, and she finds him very entertaining. Larry David doesn't come along every day. He's an unusual person in real life and on the show. And I can understand how in real life someone would be married to someone like Larry David, because he's intelligent. He sees the world through a different lens, which is fascinating to witness. So I can understand it.
Now, have you met Larry David's real wife?
I have.
How does she compare to the character you play as his wife?
That's a good question, because I haven't spent very much time with Lori David. I really just sort of run into her. It sounds awful to say, but at award shows. It sounds very pretentious, doesn't it? but they're two different people. You know, people always ask me if I'm doing an impersonation of Larry's real wife. And when the show started, I had not even met her. So I don't really know how I compare to her. I imagine that we're pretty different. But I imagine on some levels, there's probably the same dynamic going on. I imagine in real life, he probably is a little annoying, but really funny.
Have you, because you've played the part of Cheryl David so long, and because the part is improvised so often, mm-hmm. do you feel like you sometimes go through life as her and imagine how she would be responding?
Only when I'm with Larry. Only when I'm hanging out with him socially. You know, if we're, I don't know what we might be doing. Now I've conjured up thoughts of us, like, hanging out, watching a Dodgers game, which we don't. But if for some reason we're someplace together, and I will, like, someone will come up and start talking to him and reminiscing with him about something that they did, and he'll just look at him and go, "What's your name?" So then I have to, you know, have a talk with them. I'm like, "Larry, you don't just blurt out what's your name to someone who obviously knows you." You know, he's like, "Well, why not?" It's because it's rude, for starters. He's like, "Well, if you don't know their name," I go, "There are other ways to do it, you know." So, yeah, I do find myself reacting as Cheryl David sometimes.
That's so funny. I feel like we know so much, or those of us who watch the show know so much about you as Larry David's wife on the show. But tell us something about yourself, about where you grew up, what your family was like.
I grew up in Tallahassee, Florida. I grew up in Florida. I was born in Miami and lived in a little town outside of Orlando. And my whole family lives there now. And I have two brothers and a sister. You know, I grew up in kind of a small town, so my dad's, I'm not going to say redneck, but kind of. So, I mean, we grew up with not a lot of money. You know, my grandfather had orange groves, and that was our weekend, was he would drive us around his orange grove in the back of his pickup truck, and we'd run around the orange groves. So it certainly wasn't a big city experience for me.
Did you ever know anybody like Larry David before doing the show? Because I mean, he is so urban. I mean, he's very much out of Brooklyn, very much from a Jewish family, very much a certain type of neurotic. Did you know anyone like that?
Well, no. I had never met anyone like Larry before I walked in the room and met him that day. You know, even growing up where I grew up, I don't think I had one Jewish friend growing up. So when I moved out to Los Angeles, I actually started out as I was bartending, and then I got a job as an assistant to Rob Reiner and his family. So that was my first introduction to a Jewish family. And I sort of educated myself through that, because I would have to buy the kids, like, Passover coloring, not, Yeah, like Hanukkah coloring books and things like that. And so I started learning a little bit here and there about the Jewish faith. And then when I met Larry, we started shooting the show, and he was thinking that I was going to be Jewish. His wife would be Jewish. And about halfway through our first season, he looked at me and said, I don't think anybody thinks that you're Jewish. I said, well, I don't know what to tell you. I'm trying. And then we decided that it would probably be funnier if I wasn't anyway, so. I had never met anybody neurotic like Larry.
I think that's what part of what makes the relationship so interesting is that because you don't fall into predictable patterns with him, since you never knew anybody like him, there's something very kind of surprising at how you deal with him. and that works.
Well, thank you. Well, you know, my family, I grew up, it was very easygoing. Everything was easygoing. So Larry's character on the show is the opposite of that.
Yes.
And so I'm always trying to adjust to it. But in real life, we also have that dynamic, so it's kind of an easy crossover.
Cheryl Hines plays Cheryl David, Larry David's wife, in the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. Our interview is recorded in November. Our series Last Laughs, featuring some of our more entertaining interviews of 2004, continues tomorrow. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Madeline Peru's new CD. This is Fresh Air. Madeline Peru was born in Georgia, but grew up mostly in France, where she sang on the streets of Paris and sang old jazz and blues tunes with a traveling band. When her debut album was released in 1996, the young singer was often compared to Billie Holiday. The much-belated sequel is now out. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the resemblance is even stronger now that Peru's voice has matured.
Dance me to your beauty with a burning violin. Dance me through the panic till I'm gathered safely in. Lift me like an olive branch and be my homeward dove. Dance me to the end of love.
It's spooky how much Madeline Peru can sound like middle period Billie Holiday. We don't say she's Holiday's equal, or people will listen to her in 60 years. But where other singers imitate Holiday's mannerisms and ways of paraphrasing a melody as a stunt, Peru lives in that style. She sounds inspired by the natural resemblance between her heavy-lidded timbre and Holiday's.
Show me slowly what I only know the limits of. Dance me to the end of love. Dance me to the end.
Madeline Peru sings two lesser-known Billie Holiday vehicles on her new CD, Careless Love. But she makes her mark on more contemporary songs, like that Leonard Cohen tune. Her version of Bob Dylan's You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go makes you wonder what material Holiday might have recorded if she'd lived beyond age 44. She'd only been 59 when Dylan wrote it.
You're gonna make me wonder what I'm doing. Staying far behind. Without you, you're gonna make me wonder what I'm saying. Gonna make me give myself a good talking to. I look for you in old Honolulu.
that's good enough to make you forget, if not forgive, the Starland Vocal Band's version. Madeline Peru's new album has problems, but they have nothing to do with her singing. Four tunes were written before 1931, and there's a faintly cute, archaic quality to some arrangements. The shuffle beats and mildly fancy chords that sound jazzy to folkies and popsters may just sound corny to jazz folk. Even with the fine jazz organist Larry Goldings and all-purpose session guitarist Dean Parks on board, the band can come off like kids trying on grandparents' clothes in the attic. The style might work if the fit was better. Lonesome Road, from the 1929 movie of Showboat. Madeline Peru's Careless Love includes one tune she wrote with her friend Jesse Harris, who gave a big hit to Nora Jones. We'll sidestep that comparison, except to note that Peru, a guitar strummer who records for the Roots label Rounder, sounds jazzier than Jones, who's on a jazz label. Madeline Peru's singing works for me because the more I listen, the more she sounds like herself. She makes something authentically hers out of something borrowed. But even if she just reminds you of what you love about another singer, what's the harm in that?
So when I hear them say there's better living, let them go their way to that new living. I won't ever stray, 'cause this is heaven to me.
Kevin Whitehead teaches at the University of Kansas. He's also jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Madeline Peru's new CD, Careless Love. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publisher of Tree, A New Vision of the American Forest by photographer James Balog, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our series Last Laughs, featuring some of our more entertaining interviews of 2004. We'll hear from Matt Groening, cartoonist and creator of The Simpsons. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.